Welcome back to the Make or Break Show, where each week we bring you stories of incredible makers and the make or break moments that have defined them along the way. I'm your host, Brandon Cullum, and this week we chat with Keith Decent about making art, making audio, and making a living. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. We've got another fun one for you, as always, this week. First and foremost, hope you guys are having an amazing Thanksgiving. This is actually coming out, I think on Thanksgiving Day. So this is coming out on Thursday. So hope you guys are having a blast with your family. One thing that I'm really thankful for is you guys. This show has been coming out for a little over a year now, and it's been a really, really fun journey. I've gotten to talk to a lot of crazy, fun people, and it's really been cool to hear from you and your feedback and the things you guys enjoy and the things that I can change. So thank you for being a part of this journey. Super excited about 2019 and the things we've got planned. I definitely want to continue the show and make it even better. But just thank you guys so much. This has been a really fun to put together and a really fun project to work on. And a special thank you to all the wonderful patrons over on Patreon. If you guys would like to support the show, you can head over to patreon.com/makeorbreakshow. There's a bunch of different reward levels, as always. Some things you guys can get, and your support helps with the hosting of the show, as well as some of my time and scheduling and getting this thing put out on a weekly basis. All right, so jumping into this week's interview, we're chatting with Keith Decent. Keith's stuff has been really cool for a long time, especially over on Instagram. I think it's the first time that I saw some of his stuff. He does these really cool reclaimed, unique pieces. He'll take everything from a fridge to a guitar to who knows what, and turns it into these really cool pieces of functional art, whether it's furniture or just things to put up on your wall. He's got a pretty long background on the art side of things, like more traditional, maybe drawing and painting, all the way into the making world. And something more recently he's been working on, and something I definitely wanted to talk to him about on this show, is he is doing his own podcast called From the Ground Up. All right, so you might be thinking, another podcast, so what? This isn't kind of your traditional three people talking, which there are a lot of great ones out there that do that, or even kind of like this show that's more interview-based and brings in someone new each week. But if you guys listen to podcasts outside of the making world, you probably are familiar with more of the story-driven shows. This could be like This American Life or Reply All from Gimlet. They are pretty research intensive, and they dive into different topics. And Keith is no different. He picks a different topic. He goes way back and kind of walks you through the story of that topic. It's really good. He's got about 8 episodes out, and he actually just had one come out a couple days ago, all about The Screw. There is a link to that in the show notes. I encourage you to check it out. But there's a lot of work that goes into these, a lot of research. And then you got to write a script, and then you got to record the audio, then you got to master it with cool sound. A lot more than what goes into this one. So if you guys like audio and you like podcasts and you like making, which I would imagine is all of those things, if you guys are listening to me right now, be sure and check his show out. Again, it's From the Ground Up. Head over there, subscribe. He's doing really cool stuff. In addition to that, Keith is just an awesome maker in his own right, especially working with reclaimed materials. And we get into a bunch of that in this interview. So without further ado, let's jump into our interview with Keith Decent. All right, guys, welcome back to the Make or Break Show. We're hanging out with Keith Decent today, calling in from New York, hanging out with his cats and doing who knows what today. But man, thank you so much for jumping on and chat with me. Looking forward to getting into your background, all the cool stuff you do on the audio as well as on the making side.
Cool. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So excited to get into your story. I've definitely seen your stuff for a while now. And then more, I guess, recently hearing your voice on an ongoing basis, just with the podcast that you're doing From the Ground Up, which has been really cool to see. And kind of, we'll probably start at the end a little bit, but what was kind of your inspiration for that podcast and wanting to put it out?
I wanted to do a podcast for a long time, and every time I thought about maybe doing one like a panel show with somebody else, everyone was all kind of busy and taken, or yeah, has no interest in doing one until somebody with more YouTube followers asked them.
Right.
And so I was like, you know what, I could do one myself, but how exactly would I do a podcast by myself? And I kind of just completely ripped off like NPR style, like the Radiotopia Gimlet podcast.
Yeah.
Storytelling, kind of investigative type. And I figured no one else is really doing that in the makerspace in our kind of community as far as podcasts go. So I just started writing scripts and figured I would get over the fact that I don't like my voice recorded. At least within three episodes, I would at least get over that. So
yeah, yeah. Well, you have an awesome voice for this though. Like, it's a cool, like, gravelly, but like, it's a good, like, radio voice. Thanks, and I mean, yeah, in the best way.
Years of abuse. Yeah. It's like the Tom Waits. I'm on my path down to Tom Waitsville.
That's a good one to go after. Yeah. When I was starting just the interviewing, I was like, I know it'll be a little bit more work just because of the scheduling side and all that kind of stuff. But then what you're doing is, for people that don't know, I mean, that's a good deal of work. I mean, you're writing full scripts for everything you're doing. Is that right?
Yeah. It's between a 5 and 8 page script, every episode, which is about, 10 to 15 minutes read. And then once I put in everything in the audio, in the edit, I mean, after I put everything together and put in all the breaks because I talk too fast and put in some music, it becomes about between a 10 and 20 minute podcast, depending on the story I'm telling. But that's also about, it's hard to gauge how many hours of research there are.
Okay.
But I think the most I've done so far was the one I'm putting out hopefully tonight, which is probably about 30 hours of research.
Good night.
Just, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. Where do you get, like, your ideas or your, like, your topic ideas?
Luckily, when you make a podcast about, like, stuff, you realize that there's lots of stuff around. I guess, right. I just kind of look around the workshop and I'm like, I wonder where that came from or who thought of that first. Or
yeah,
like, I like to think of simple things that we all have lying around that no one really knows the history of.
Yeah.
Or I just, if I hear about something cool, like I did an episode on Brian May's guitar, the guitarist from Queen, and how he built it with his dad. And that was like one of those serendipitous things where it just happened around Father's Day. So it was just the right timing. And he made his guitar out of reclaimed materials and they worked together on it. And it was the story just, it sounded great. And I saw an article on it because he just wrote a book about it.
Oh, cool.
And I was like, sure, I'm going to do that. Let's dig into that story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's a lot of work what you're doing. And I definitely encourage people to check it out from the ground up. Is it just from the, or FTGU podcast?
FTGUpodcast.com.
Okay.
Sorry.
No. Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
The cat bit me. I'm trying to get her to not be me out through the whole thing.
Did you say she bit you or she like?
Well, she's being playful, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Did. Gotcha. The amount of work that you're putting into it, I can't imagine compared to like the three person panel show. It's you're not just hitting record for an hour. So.
Exactly. It's not just hit record and then bleep out the curses and hit upload. It's why I'm only doing one a month for now. I'm kind of dipping my toe into it, and hopefully the Patreon funds or some advertising comes through and I can do a little more, because I'm really enjoying it so far. It was just a weird idea that I had.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I jumped wholly into it. Now it's taken off a bit. People really seem to enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a great one. Because initially I was like, I'd love to do some more of those like NPR style shows. And I was like, no way. The amount of work is going to take forever. So
luckily I'm good at research. I just have a knack for it. So it works out that way.
Yeah. What's like the research process look like?
Mostly it's just Googling and digging deeper. The easiest step one is go to the Wikipedia article and then scroll all the way to the bottom to the sources and then just start from there.
And so then, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh yeah. That was, I try to find like, an interesting hinge for the story, like something like a crux to it, something I can delve into and tell the human side, or at least the history side of what's going on. And then I build out from there. So it doesn't always run linearly. It's not like, I just say, okay, the first thing that happened in the story is this, the next thing is that. Yeah. I like to focus on a very interesting part and build more of a cinematic kind of story out of it and then narrate the whole thing through.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like you almost have to have that like character, something like you can relate to on like a human level for people to get pulled into it.
Yeah, the one I'm working on now, I just finished recording last night, was it's the history of the screw. And oh, cool. I start off with a shipwreck being discovered off the coast of the port of Rotterdam in the Netherlands. So,
yeah,
you know, that's like a sample of how like I would, you know, go from one thing to the other. That's it doesn't seem like it would make any sense, but it actually kind of works with the whole thing.
No, that's good. So what podcast do you listen to then?
I listen to a buttload of podcasts. Okay. I mean, yeah, I like Radiolab, NPR, 99% Invisible is huge. The one I probably steal the most from is called Memory Palace with Nate DiMeo.
Yes.
Which is literally him just telling a story. It's like between 8 and 10 minutes, and it's like once a month. It's a fantastic podcast, and he does a great job. Anything that's good storytelling. I'm burnt out on true crime podcasts like everybody else seems to be getting. Yeah, and all the Maker ones. I listen to as many of the Maker podcasts as I can, even though there's 5 billion of them now.
Yeah, yeah. What podcast, when they have an episode come out, like goes to the top of your list of stuff to listen to?
You know, it really depends on I'm one of those people. It depends on the title and the topic. I listen to Reclaimed Audio every time. Those guys have great chemistry, honestly. Yeah. Just when they're talking to each other, it's a pleasure to listen to them. Making It Wood Talk, the Modern Woodworkers Association, Modern Maker Podcast. Those I tend to listen to right away.
Okay. Yeah.
Mostly cause they're my friends.
Right. Right.
And no offense, it depends on who's being interviewed on an interview podcast. If I've never heard of them, I'll take a time when I can soak it in a little more.
If
I'm down in a workshop, then I like to listen to more of an interview style podcast or something with a deeper story that I can, you know, kind of tune in for.
Yeah. The three people talking, it's like once you get to know them all, like they're hard to not listen to. Cause it, like you said, it's just like catching up with friends. So.
Exactly. Like you're on a car ride. It's like having three extra people in the car with you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool. Yeah. I don't want to talk to you about podcasts all the time, cause I definitely could, but, so you mentioned storytelling a few times. Do you have like a background in that at all? Or is that just something you've always naturally been interested in, or where does that kind of come in?
No, in the few instances that I've had to write stuff in my life, being an artist pretty much since my youth, I've just been told that I'm a good writer, and it eventually you get told something enough and you have to assume that there's some pebble of truth to it.
Yeah.
And so I've just been working on those skills. You know, every time I have an opportunity to, like if I'm writing copy for a website or if I'm writing my bio or whatever it is, I will try to sharpen that as much as I can.
What type of art were you into then as a kid?
Comic books. Almost entirely comic books. Yeah, that was that's how I got started doing just about everything, was drawing the characters, drawing the covers over and over again, then drawing my own really ridiculously terrible comic books and stapling them together, you know, on the computer paper.
What were the ones you were into?
Oh, Spider-Man's the biggest one for me.
Okay.
Hands down. Spider-Man, X-Men, I like them all, honestly. Like, and then like as I got older, I got into more kind of independent comics and stuff, but there's an independent comic called Scud, the Disposable Assassin, which has had like a lasting impact on me. It's done by this guy named Rob Schraub, and it was in the 90s, and it's insane. It's just a crazy comic. It's about an assassin robot that was taken out of a vending machine to stop the end of the world by killing one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and it's something I'd recommend. If somebody loves comic books, check out Scud, the Disposable Assassin. You can get anthologies of it now.
That's crazy. So are you going to have some type of making slant of Marvel, like Stanley, any of that kind of stuff here recently? Like, is there going to be like an episode around that?
I've been trying to figure out an entry point into that, because you don't want to do it like, well, especially, I mean, Stanley's passing had a huge impact on me because his work had a huge impact on me. But when someone dies, it's tough to have something prepared, obviously. Mm-hmm. So you want to get it. I want to get something out, but I don't want to rush it, you know?
Yeah.
So it would probably be, I mean, my turnaround on an episode is usually a couple of months worth. I get the idea, then I've got it writing in the background of when I'm doing something else and researching. And then, you know, a couple months later, the idea comes out. It doesn't usually happen very quickly.
Yeah. So were you like the art kid then in high school?
Yeah.
Or was that?
Oh, okay. Yeah. That was me. I was a president of the art club 2 years in a row. That was my background and all I wanted to do all the time.
Were you painting, drawing, like just everything? Like what were the mediums you were working in?
It was almost entirely 2D art. So I started out with illustrating because the comic books got me there. So I was really good with a Micron pen and a few sheets of paper. I got into painting and then I went to art school and college briefly. I didn't finish college because I had some fundamental disagreements with what they were teaching. Basically, I wanted to be an artist and they wanted to turn me into a businessman. And I wasn't really having that. And I got into painting after college, and I've been painting ever since. So,
What about the business piece in college did you not like?
Well, what it was, I was already running kind of a successful graphic design firm when I went into college.
Okay.
Cause it was that .com bubble at that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, people were just throwing money at you if you had any idea what you were doing on the internet. And so I was doing that and I wanted to go for painting, sculpting, drawing, you know, the hard arts and stuff. I really felt like I had a gap and needed to fill, like, cause I was already better at programming and graphic design. And they said, yeah, sure. Come on. We got that. We're going to be teaching all that great stuff. It's in the curriculum. So I applied and got in and went there. And as I got there, they were like, oh, we're changing the whole curriculum. We're focusing on illustration and graphic design and how to be a business, like the business of, you know, digital art and stuff. And I just was not having it for a couple of years.
Yeah. Was that, where was that at?
University of Michigan School of Art.
Oh, Michigan. Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
So when you left, were you still just freelancing? Was that kind of your next step?
Yeah, I was freelancing. And right when I got back, I decided I was like, I'll just go back and reopen my business and get some of my old clients back and start again. And the bubble burst and the economy tanked.
Yeah.
And that was my introduction to digging holes for a living, for money. Just whatever I could do at that point was what I was doing.
Wait, so when... So you started the business, sounds like, in high school then, if you're going into college with it?
Yeah.
Was that
building websites in seventh grade?
Okay.
Professionally.
Yeah. On the business side of things, like, I know most seventh graders, I wasn't thinking of like running my own business and like charging people for stuff. Like, was that weird? Like, were your parents entrepreneurs? Like, where does that come from?
No, my parents weren't entrepreneurs. That was just the right place at the right time. I was good at it. And I had a couple people who were family friends and, one of them was my sister's boss at this store out in this summer town where we used to work in the summers and go into summers. And they knew that I could do it and they knew that I was a kid, so they could undercharge me. They could lowball me and I'd be super happy about it.
Right.
And that's kind of how it worked out. So I only did, when I say seventh grade professionally, maybe I did two websites in seventh grade and helped with some coding. And then by about when I was 14, 15 years old is when I was actually doing the work, sitting in front of the computer in the guy's office, being hired freelance for that sort of thing.
Gotcha. So when you went to, it sounds like construction, were you also still trying to keep the art side of stuff alive on the side in your free time, or was it you're just pretty much just making a living?
I was just making a living. It wasn't just the construction. It was kind of whatever would come my way. Okay. I did some PA work for photo shoots for a while. You know, stand here, hold that, move this. Just the grunt work is basically what I was doing with everything.
Yeah.
And then I saved up enough money, moved back to the city and started DJing karaoke for a while. That was a lot of fun.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been all over the place. Was a Zamboni driver for a little while after college, just whatever. if you would pay me for a thing and I thought I could logically do it, I would do it. That was basically it.
Yeah. Wait, so how do you DJ karaoke?
Like, it's a whole thing. There's a program and it kind of has all the songs and stuff like that. And basically you're running the party and someone comes up and requests whatever they want to do. And you got to punch the code in and put it up and make sure that they don't break anything. And it's just, it's like being a bartender without the fun parts.
Yeah. No, there's like no alcohol that at least you're serving.
I mean, I got to drink for free, which is good. I think they realized the mental health tax that came with being the karaoke DJ in the back room was just to give me free bottom shelf liquor.
Yeah. You're just listening to people just horribly sing all day.
Yeah. Yeah. Some people were really good, but some people were really bad. As long as I had fun. Excuse me. That was the most fun part.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was kind of the craziest job you had? Was that it during that kind of period?
Probably. Yeah. The job itself wasn't too crazy after a while. It was literally just running a program on a computer and maintaining a list.
Yeah.
But everything else that happened around the job was the crazy stuff. I mean, if you've ever worked or anybody's ever worked nightlife at a bar in a place like Brooklyn, New York in the mid 2000s, it's kind of, you know, it gets pretty zany.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nothing. Stories I can't really tell on a podcast for the most part.
that's totally fine. So were you doing art then throughout this period or was it?
Yeah, sometimes. I lived in a loft with three roommates and I built some stuff for the loft, furniture wise, like simple, you know, like a beer bong table or whatever we needed. And I really wanted to do more of that. And it turns out that there was just no good dust collection for any of my tools. So I had like a circular saw, and we built lofts and we built the bedrooms up in the loft. And my roommates realized that just a cloud of sawdust is always going to float right into their bedrooms every time I do anything.
Yeah.
So that kind of put the, kind of cut that off pretty quick for me. But I did, I made comics here and there. I used to make like whenever I got to it, daily-esque, little slice of life comic for a while. That's mostly what I was doing. I'm really like straining my brain, because I think most of the time it was just being hungover and trying to make it back to work on time for a couple of years.
Yeah. So was that like on the making side of things, more traditional people think making, the building like furniture and stuff, was that kind of your first entry into that, or had you always kind of been working with tools in addition to kind of the fine art stuff?
Yeah, no, I didn't work with tools very much. I got a taste of it here and there doing the grunt work for these other jobs. But my uncle, who was a contractor and a very, very good contractor and a good guy, said that he would help build the lofts into this big empty loft apartment that we were moving into, my friends and I. So one of them was an architect. So he designed the space using like as little OSB and plywood as we could. Like he optimized the whole design and everything. And then my uncle and I went in there and built it in 3 days. And that was kind of my kick in the butt getting back towards making stuff. At that point, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So as you're working the odd jobs, was there a point where you wanted to move towards maybe something you had a little more ownership of, or like running your own thing? Or was it kind of like a natural evolution to where you're at now?
Yeah, it just kind of happened that way. I've always been able to work for myself better than I've been able to work for somebody else. Just the way my brain works.
Yeah.
And, so in my experience from when I was younger, having my own business, I knew I could do it. I don't necessarily love running my own business. It would be great if I had, I made enough money to have like an accountant or something, but, no, for the most part it's just, I'm more comfortable with it. When I have ownership over a thing, I know that that thing can be as good as I can make it. And then that way I can, it all falls on me, which is a lot easier for me to deal with. I'm sure people can relate. When you start handing off parts of your business to other people to try to handle some of the responsibilities, it's like I just become intolerable. I'm like the guy over the shoulder all the time.
Right.
Like, yeah, why don't you do it like this? And they're a professional, and I've been doing it in spare time for like 3 weeks, and I think I know better.
Yeah. So were you building small projects? Were you selling art? How were you actually making money from your own?
Yeah. What I ended up doing after I just had enough of the nightlife stuff down in the city, I ended up moving back up to Yonkers, where I grew up, which is just outside of New York City. And my cousin was doing estate sale cleanouts, and I knew enough about old tools and I was good at research. And so I was the guy in the basement of the estate sale where the guy who was the master carpenter in the 1950s. Passed away and left all his tools to nobody. And so we had to sell them. So I was down in the basement. I was the guy who was basically pricing everything, selling it, negotiating the deals. And
yeah,
I started kind of building a collection of cool stuff up from there, because I've always liked antiques and old stuff and weird things. And then we started getting tables at local flea markets to help with the extra stuff that we had. At the end of a sale, you don't know what to do with everything. And the homeowners usually like just throw it out. Just get rid of it because it's either not theirs or they don't want it or whatever. And so we would keep the really cool stuff that we thought was worth something because we're pack rats. And then we'd sell it at flea markets. And I started seeing people who were making their own stuff at the flea markets. And I was pretty well convinced that I could do a better job than they were. And a few YouTube videos later, and I was putting together skis as a like old wooden skis as an end table, or making a bench out of an old theater chair, or stuff that was already pretty much mostly manufactured. I was just screwing it together in interesting ways, and it caught on from there. And I fell in love with it, and I just started doing more actual woodworking and metalworking later on.
So at that point, were you mostly selling like at flea markets, or like were you selling anything online? Okay.
Entirely. I had an Etsy store, but it was, Etsy's a fickle mistress, if you're selling something truly unique on Etsy, you're going to have a really hard time getting people to go to your your site, your page. And if you're selling the same thing as everyone else, you're gonna have a really hard time standing out, because it's a lot of hobbyists selling stuff at almost a loss, because they don't, you know, if the only person you have to answer to is maybe your spouse to break even for your hobby, then you're going to be undercutting pretty much every professional out there trying their best to get things done.
Yeah. So on the unique materials, cause that's definitely something when I look like through, whether it's your YouTube, your Instagram, or your old work, like it's always these like just crazy materials, not crazy materials, but like crazy things you're building out of materials. Has that like reclaimed piece, was that out of necessity to start out, or is that always kind of like, I really want to like use stuff that was meant for something else, but kind of bring it back to life?
It was kind of both. It's really easy to make something if half of the manufacturing has already been done for you.
Yeah.
Which is nice, because if you're selling at flea markets, you got turnover and you got to have new stuff, and it's like a weekly thing, you know? So if I can build something in 3 days because it's already a box, like a cabinet or an old suitcase or something like that, and put legs on it, then hell, I'm going to do that, you know? Plus, I also really like the artistic challenge of looking at something and seeing what I can do with it. Mm-hmm. And I do a lot of, I would look on Pinterest or something and see what everyone else had done with that object, and then try really hard to do something different, just slightly different even, but do it just not exactly the same way.
What is the craziest thing you've like transformed?
Probably the 1940s refrigerator into a rolling dry bar. That was one of them. That just was, I mean, it was heavy. It was sitting in storage for a long time. That's the one thing that always pops to mind first is the fridge, because I would make a joke. I'd have people ask me why I don't sell plans for my projects. And I'm like, well, when the plan starts with go find an abandoned refrigerator from the 1950s, I don't think step two is going to happen very often.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, probably the fridge. And there's a really terrible video of that on my YouTube channel. I lost so much footage, and I just stitched it together. And I was like, yeah, that's the best I could do.
Yeah, yeah. So you, because you've been on YouTube, what, about 3 years? Is that right?
I think, yeah, it's four, I think, now. I don't know. Four, okay. I mean, how long have I been taking it seriously? That's a different story.
But for a while. So were you, were you just watching other people post? And so you're like, I should like throw some of my stuff, own stuff out there as well?
Yeah, just like everybody else. I saw Jimmy DiResta, and I was like, oh, I could do that. And then I realized how immensely talented he is.
Yeah.
Not just to be making this stuff, but to be balancing even his simple style of video. There's a genius to it, how elegant it is, because he always gets the right shot. He always makes it work, and it's worth watching, even though there's not much going on in terms of behind the scenes editing, you know?
Yeah.
It seems like he's just pointing the camera at the thing and going.
Yeah.
But if you just point the camera at the thing and go, it's going to be terrible.
Right. Right.
You know? So. So I saw him making stuff, and then I did my first video, which is, I think I bent an old aluminum ruler into a money clip. I think that was the first one I put out. And I was like, yeah, that was easy. Not realizing how just awful that video was. And I loved it from there. I just kept going.
Did you know Jimmy at that point? And for people that don't know who we're talking about, Jimmy DiResta. So since you were both in, like, I guess kind of the same area.
Yeah, we're really close to get, I did not know him. Okay. It turns out that he was on Twitter one day this is the story of how I first met him, I guess. He was on Twitter one day talking about, or his podcast. He was on his podcast, and he was saying something along the lines of, he had all these tools that he had to get rid of and make space for. And he guess he's just going to raffle them off to listeners maybe. And I sent him a message on Twitter, and I was like, hey, I just started a maker cooperative with a couple other people. And I was like, we could use some tools. If you don't mind, if I come up and like maybe get one or two of those, he's like, come take them all. So I was like, all right. So we borrowed my friend's truck and drove up and met Jimmy on his farm. And he gave me a whole bunch of tools.
That's crazy. That's really cool.
That's just him. He's like the nicest guy.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah. All right. So maker co-op, is that like you guys are sharing like collaborative tools? Is that the idea?
It was so when I was selling at the local flea market here in Beacon, where I live now, there's a few people around, and one of the other guys at the booth next to me, we just started commiserating over having to stand in a hot parking lot from 6 a.m. until 6 p.m. And we got to talking and realized that maybe we'd do better if we pooled our resources and sold out of one tent instead of two, because we were doing similar things. And that was my friend Rob. And we became kind of creative partners and started pushing each other a little more. And we brought in another guy who was an interior designer who was also doing repurposing and reclaiming. And then another guy who we taught who wanted to learn woodworking. So we had an interior designer, an engineer, basically, me, the artist. We had a guy who wanted to learn, and we had a couple more people after that that got added. We ended up with a store space through just happenstance here on Main Street, which is not easy to get. We had a really good time for a couple of years, and then we realized that owning a store kind of sucks because you have to be there all the time.
Yeah.
And everyone just kind of ended up going their separate ways after a couple of years, but it was fun. We shared ownership of the direction that we went in, but we all sold stuff on under our own kind of business through it. So it was a cooperative effort, but we each reaped our own reward for how much work we put in.
Yeah, that's cool. How would you go about like setting up a shop, like a collaborative shop versus just having something one off?
That was like what we were tackling right as it tapered off. Okay. We were looking for a collaborative space. And so I don't really know. Okay. It was just, that was a problem we were trying to solve, which is how we get a space together, how we make sure membership can support the space, and how, you know, what tools go in and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, so you guys were thinking full like makerspace.
Yeah, kind of, but okay. Like kind of private makerspace to begin with.
Got it.
Okay. Just for like the five of us. And then maybe I wanted to expand. I kind of had, a bit of a little mini dream at that point to open a makerspace and have it be that way. But I realized that I'm just not one for management. So
yeah. I can imagine that can get just turned into a mess with everybody coming in and out and all that.
Yeah. I'd rather go into the shop and make something than sit there and do timetables for everybody else to make something.
Yes. I totally get that. So, fast forward to today, is it mostly still selling like custom pieces? Is that where like a lot of your work goes towards?
Yeah, most of it. When it slows down, I take up odd jobs here and there doing like finished carpentry, or, you know, if someone needs like, hell, someone needs their lawn raked, I'll do that if I'm short on cash.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's mostly selling custom stuff directly to customers. I have a lot of great local customers here. It ends up being a lot of floating shelves and rustic barn doors in between what I actually like doing.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to make that transition more towards kind of content creation, but yeah, it's a slow drive that way.
Yeah. How do you get customers? Is it just over the years you've built up kind of a client base?
Yeah. For the most part, my Instagram following is kind of substantial, and it's been a lot of local followers. I did a really good job early on making sure that just about everyone in my city knew who I was.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. You know, using local hashtags and kind of like, you know, tagging the right locations for everything and handing out business cards at the flea market and all that. So that way, when people, I'm the first person a lot of people think of when it comes to custom work. And also when it comes to, I've got this thing that I want to get rid of, but I don't want to haul it all the way to the dump.
Yeah.
They'll drive by my house first and ask me if I want it, you know?
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask, kind of what the creative process looks like for you. Does it start with kind of the material, or is it kind of a bunch of different things?
It really depends. I think more these days I've been, because I've gotten to the point where I can fabricate a lot better than I used to be able to from raw material or raw-ish material.
Yeah.
It becomes a lot more idea first these days, but still like it used to be for me, still a lot of the time I can look at an object and say, I know exactly what I want to do with that, or I have a good idea of what I want to do with that, and then work at it from there. So it's 60-40 idea first or material first for me.
So do clients come to you with ideas, or are you saying, hey, this is a cool idea, who wants to get this?
It's funny because as I talk about getting away from custom work, I realize that I'm actually really fortunate in the way that I operate, because a lot of people who do custom work will tell you they're tired of getting approached with someone with an open restoration hardware catalog that says, hey, can you make this table but cheaper or bigger or smaller or whatever?
Yeah,
because that gets really tiresome, because no, I can't make that cheaper for you. This is not how it works. Nowadays, what I get most of is someone just tells me, hey, I've got this open spot, I like this kind of style that you do, here's the kind of piece of furniture I want, I want your piece. So it's more of like an art commission a lot of the time for me now, which is good.
Almost like a design brief, sounds like.
Exactly, yeah. They'll just say, hey, I want a record console, like kind of mid-century-ish, but also rustic, which is something I do. And, you know, it's got to be this big. And so I'm like, okay. And I just draw some designs and see what they like and then go from there.
So you've got the brief. How do you work through designs? Like, are you iterating on a bunch of different things? Like, how does, what's that?
Well, I learned in the days of doing graphic design for people not to give too much the client, because you end up, you know, with like, oh, I want a piece of this and I want that and I want this and I want that. It's easier for me to approach them with the finished one that I like the most.
Okay.
And then maybe a couple of little vignettes of, I hand draw my plans too. If I need to draw plans at all, I hand draw them. It's just quicker for me. With a couple of vignettes of like, here's how I can do the corner a little different, or maybe this angle could splay out this way instead of going straight. And that usually works really well. So
that's cool. So is your shop then at your house, or is it separate?
Yeah, it's in my basement.
Okay.
The room I'm in now is actually my studio. It's a dining room, living room kind of combination.
Cool.
And I don't need a dining room because it's just me. So I have a workbench over there, and this is kind of where I do the soft art for the most part. Or if I'm like putting hinges on something, I'll do it up here.
Yeah.
And the dirty work happens down in the basement, which is an inch shorter than I am. So.
Oh no.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's one of those things.
It's like a cave.
Yeah, pretty much.
I guess I didn't realize watching your videos how short those ceilings were. That's nuts.
Yeah, that's why you don't realize it, because I literally can't do like a full body shot, because I just be like, I just have my neck cricked to the side.
It's all like real tight cropped in.
It's all real tight cropped. Yeah, exactly.
So are you also then doing just pieces just for you, like just for fun, or is it mostly commissioned stuff?
I try to do pieces just for me. It's time considerations for the most part.
Yeah.
I did one that I know I'm not going to sell, which was the hand tools thing, which was basically I carved my hand and then I took the handles of a bunch of different tools like an ice pick, a X-Acto knife, and some carving tools, and I carved them to look like my fingers. And so they go into the main part of the hand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like a stand for tools, but it's hand tools and it is a hand and the tools are fingers. It's one of the weird things I had an idea for, and I was like, well, that's mine. So I kept that one.
That's cool. But yeah, that, because you did a video on that like several months ago, right?
Yeah, that was at least 6 months ago, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And I'm doing a foot plane pretty soon too, which is going to be a hand plane that looks like a foot. It looks like my foot.
Is usable?
Yeah, it's going to be completely usable. And I don't know why I'm doing these things, but it's just the idea I had. And I'm like, I think people will watch this.
Yeah, so. Yeah. That's cool. So you mentioned that that content was a piece you wanted to build up, especially on the business side. Mm-hmm. So what does that look like when you're thinking through, especially like looking into 2019? Is it producing more interesting pieces and video, and kind of how are you thinking through that?
Yeah, it's mostly trying to produce better work and more interesting work, and that way get the attention for what I want, as opposed to being a guy who can make a table out of a suitcase, which there's a trillion of online. I'd rather be the guy who can turn a hand plane into a foot, and then and that way I can bring people along with my journey, as opposed to just kind of trying to serve what I think they want to see.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So from the ground up, you mentioned once a month right now.
Mm-hmm. If I can. I mean,
if you can, yeah.
This month's going to be two, because last month I did zero, because that's just what happens sometimes.
So do you want to build that up on release side of things, if like financially you can support it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I have a Patreon for it, which is, I tell people, it's funny because the podcast is short and it's once a month. So everyone, it's always leaving wanting more, and everyone keeps telling me, I just want more episodes. We want more.
Yes. Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
It's grown a pretty rabid following, which is fantastic, because I love all the fans of it. But I tell everyone it grows in direct proportion to the funds in my Patreon account. Basically, like, I have the goals there. You want another show, then give me enough money to make another show every month, because, you know, that's a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah. So is the, when you talk about growing, is it you would just be diverting more of your time to that versus doing commission pieces? Is that kind of how you see? Okay.
Exactly. It has to take over a certain part of my budget per month to make sense time wise. And gotcha. That way I can X out, I can, you know, stop going and hanging doors for people and, do the podcast instead, which is, I think, what everyone would rather have me doing, except the people who need doors hung.
Yeah, it has a bigger response. Were you surprised at the response from it?
I knew that there was a possibility that there would be a good response. I didn't think that people would like it as much, because it's different for what we usually listen to as makers in terms of our community space, but it's not very different from a lot of podcasts that are out
right.
there.
Right.
But, and I thought that way, and I realized after thinking about that, but there's no podcasts that are out there in that kind of, I keep calling it like the NPR verse, but yeah. in that space that handle making things or what I'm talking about. So it's kind of this weird bridge of middle ground that like it works out really well.
Yeah. I mean, there really aren't any like story driven shows that I can give in this world.
There are zero from what I understand. Yeah. If there are any now, it's because they've come out after I started this one. Not because of me, I'm just saying right. that I wasn't looking for similar podcasts after I had the ideas and followed through.
Are there any stories that you can talk about that you're excited about that you're working on right now?
I'm finishing tonight the history of the screw, and okay. that episode is entitled Righty Tighty Lefty Loosey, How the Ancient Greeks Screwed the World.
That's awesome.
It goes through like Archimedes and Archytas and these guys that were like these great ancient minds and thinkers, and it goes up through like the guy who did the Phillips head screws, Phillips and Robertson, and it's a long one. It took me better part of a month and a half to get that one ready. And then from there, I have a whole list. Give me 1 second. Their podcast. Let's see. I have one which is The Big Squeeze, A History of Clamps. And The Router, aka How Woodworking Got Its Groove Back.
That's cool.
Sometimes I think of the titles first.
Then. So will you work on like multiple stories at the same time, or are you
yes,
just kind of one?
Yeah, okay. That's something I can't stop my brain from doing.
Okay.
I'm halfway through one story. Like last night I was researching and writing from the research for the Screw podcast episode. And I was like, how do I branch off into Allen keys and hex keys? And I was like, no. So I just started saving all those links to the history of the Allen key, which is kind of, it's sort of interesting. It might be more interesting than I thought. That might be the next one. If I'm like a dog with a scent, like if I catch a good one, I'm just going to go after it, you know?
Yeah. So that episode, is that coming out this week?
This episode should be out tonight if everything goes properly for the rest of the day.
Cool. So at the time of this recording, we're talking on Tuesday, but this is coming out on Thursday. So that episode should already be out.
It will be out by Thursday. Absolutely. Cool. Which is Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving. I got to
remember that. So I know where to be on Thursday.
Yeah. I'll make sure to include a link in the show notes for folks. But well, cool. Well, I appreciate your time and chatting with me. Love your work and all the work you're doing into the podcast. And it's been a fun one to listen with for a while now. So.
Thanks. This has been great. And I love your podcast too. It's one of the ones I actually listen to not exactly when it hits, because I like to save it. But
right. You're like, oh, that guest is boring. I don't listen to that dude, but I'll.
Well, it's usually if I don't know who it is, because you actually have a good interview style, so it helps.
Yeah.
If I don't know who it is, I'm like, okay, I actually have to learn about this person as I listen to them. Like, you know.
Yeah, and you want to like have people like click on it, so you got to figure out a good title, and you're like, that's cool. So on your making side of things, just keithdecent.com
keithdecent.com, yep, and YouTube. Yeah, there's links, but you just search Keith Decent on YouTube, and I should be I'm, as far as I know, I'm still the only one. So,
did you do a comic on in the maker?
I had that was another brilliant idea I had, which was to do maker oriented comics, and it was fun for, you know, three comics, and then I had one that wasn't coming together properly, and I was just like, you know what, it's a medium for me that I really have to put my full effort into and make absolutely the best possible thing I can make, otherwise it's gonna fall flat and be terrible. So I kind of fell off that.
Are those out there?
No, I think I took him down.
Okay, because I thought he did a comic, and I was trying to find it. I'm like, maybe this wasn't him, but I thought it was.
No, it was me. And actually, I had guest stars in them from other makers and stuff. That would be a fun surprise. And at New York Maker Faire, I actually ended up giving those people the originals of the comics.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah, which was nice to see that they liked them and that they weren't too offended at the ridiculous situations I put them in. I did it for a little while. It was fun, but I don't see it being a major part of what I'm doing until maybe down the road if I have some other free time come up.
Got it. Cool. Well, sweet man. Well, I appreciate your time and chatting with me and all the crazy stuff you got going on.
Sorry?
I said and all the crazy stuff you got going on.
Oh, gotcha. Sorry. It blipped right... right in the middle of that sentence.
That's no, I probably just mumbled is probably what happens. So.
I do that all the time.
We'll sleep, man.
Yep. Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.